any rate, so this is Tuesday, October 19, is that right? Yeah, and we're on overhead number 17 in chapter 11. Title of it is Imogens. Okay, remember the stupidity I imposed on you yesterday when I say Zymogens, you say... It must have been so stupid you don't remember. Do you remember what we did yesterday with that? What did I say? When I said Zymogens, you're supposed to say inactive enzyme precursors. That's the word, see? Inactive enzyme precursors. And we went through and walked through all that. So let's go down to number four, factors affecting reaction velocity. By the way, these Roman numerals probably don't fit exactly. I put them in and then realized I think I'd skipped one or two. So if you're missing number three or number four or something like that, don't panic. I just put them in and then didn't get the Roman numerals right. This is kind of like the test stuff I'm doing. Factors affecting reaction velocity. Of course, substrate concentration, the more substrate you got, the faster things are going to go. This is not rocket science. That's the way it is no matter what it is, even if you have an uncatalyzed reaction or reaction catalyzed by non-enzymatic catalysts. Temperature, reaction increases with increasing temperature. Again, that's not a silly rule of thumb, the idea. What is the rule of thumb in terms of if you raise the temperature 10 degrees, what typically happens? Have you heard this rule? Reaction rates typically increase by double for every 10 degrees increase in Celsius temperature of the reaction. Boy, that was a complicated way to say it. You double the reaction rate for every 10 degree increase in temperature. That's the rule of thumb. And that's a handy thing to remember if you have to deal with some sort of back of the envelope calculations. And this is absolutely true as well with enzymatically catalyzed reactions. Of course, what is this term here? It says reaches a max and then drops, the reactivity or velocity begins to drop. What's the deal with that? What happens with that? We all know. Denaturation. Of course, the denaturation is another word for unfolding. Thank you. So it unfolds and becomes inactivated with increasing temperature. pH. Of course, that's going to dramatically affect the activity enzyme. Matter of fact, there are enzymes that are in our bodies whose pH are so dramatically different from the environment by design that if they get accidentally released into the environment surrounding the package, they become much less active. This is true for the enzymes in the lysosome. The lysosomal enzymes have a pH maximum of around 5. Of course, the lysosome is in the interior of the cell, and the interior of the cell is very close to pH of neutral, pH 7, maybe even a little basic. And so if that enzyme accidentally escapes from the lysosome into the interior of the cytosol, it has much less activity. So the ionization state, of course, can alter the conformation of the enzyme like it would any other protein, and thus distort the active site and slow it down. And so pH changes can denature protein, obviously. Then unique pH optimum exists for each unique enzyme. So depending on the environment, of course, the trypsin that exists in the stomach is going to have a different pH maximum in terms of activity than the chymotrypsin or whatever that might exist in the duodenum or small intestine. All right. Enough of that. Last slide for this overhead. We're going to do a little bit of clinical chemistry here, something directly related to medicine, dentistry, graduate school. Now, what happens is the enzymes in plasma. Now, in other words, that the one you're going to be dependent much of the time on blood tests. And so the amount of information you extract out of a blood test is enormous anymore. But typically what you find is that the enzymes found in plasma are two main sources. The Zymogens of blood clotting, right? You got that blood clotting cascade where one enzyme turns on another enzyme, which turns on another enzyme which clots blood. And enzymes that appear in the plasma with normal cell turnover. I mean, there are very few enzymes in the plasma of the blood that have an actual activity because they're in the plasma of the blood. It typically is a fairly benign substance, plasma, except for these two ideas. There's not really an enzyme, like I said, that was designed to be there. But, of course, never say never, that's just a generalization. You will eventually probably find one that's in there. But many diseases cause tissue damage that result in increased release of intracellular enzymes into the plasma. So when you find an enzyme that's not supposed to be there, if you know where that enzyme came from, you go, hey, we got some tissue damage going on there. And so that's exactly what happens. Heart, okay, that would mean like a heart attack. Liver, what's a very common liver disease people get? Cirrhosis of the liver is damaged. It's exactly right. Fine liver. And then skeletal muscle tissue damage. I'm not sure. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that's tragic because, but they still find it if you perhaps have a deep bruise or a clot that they don't suspect, and they find muscle enzymes in there, they'll start looking for a clot in your muscle tissue that wouldn't be there normally. Now, if you're looking for liver, there is an enzyme called alanine aminotransferase that they can spot pretty readily in the plasma. Also in the heart, there's elevated CK2 called creatine kinase, which is an enzyme unique to the heart. Also an elevated lactate dehydrogenase. Now, there are other lactate dehydrogenases, and there are other... I mean, I made a mistake when I said that's only existing in the heart. That's incorrect. There is an isoform or isoenzyme that's peculiar to the heart and to the, in terms of the creatine kinase and lactate dehydrogenase. So, and then finally, elevated GOT, glutamine oxaloacetate transaminase. These are unique isozymes to the heart. Now, if found in the plasma, it indicates myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, essentially one type of heart attack. Isoenzymes that catalyze the same reaction but are encoded by different genes. In other words, you've got a lactate dehydrogenase, for example, that exists in the liver. There's another one that exists in the heart. It does the exact same activity, but its primary structure is different. That's an isozyme. An isozyme. That's different than a zymogen. Zymogens are not isozymes. Isozymes are enzymes that are peculiar to a particular tissue. They have the same function as other similar enzymes in other tissues, but they can be uniquely identified by their unique primary structural differences compared to the other tissues. Isozymes. So, here you go. So, when I talk about CK2 and LDH, I'm talking about those unique isozymes unique to the heart. So, for example, the creatine kinase here. CK2 activity in plasma peaks about 24 hours after infarction. All right? And so, you got enzyme activity. And then LDH activity, plasma peaks about 36 to 40 hours after infarction. And here you see where the cells die slowly and release their contents into the plasma. So if you hear dad or mom have had a heart attack and they're in the hospital, they're taking blood tests regularly. And what they're doing is they're looking for how bad the heart attack is just by checking the blood. And they do that by noting the maximum activity here. In other words, if there's a sudden sharp rise and it reaches a very high level compared to what is considered to be normal, then your mom and dad have a really bad heart attack because lots of muscle cells have died, and lots of when they've died, they've gone into the plasma. If, however, it's a low and it slowly rises and it does not reach a very high peak or a very high value compared to what is known to be common or normal or average, then that's when they would come to you and say, well, based on the tests we've taken, your mom and dad have had a mild heart attack. And then they'll go on and do other tests to find out exactly the extent of the nature, but they can judge that simply by doing a blood test and doing an isozyme examination. What?
So the heart attack has always had the smoke deposits in it? Or what does normal
look like? You mean right here? Well, normal would be flat line. Because the isozyme that's specific for the heart, the CK2 isozyme that's specific for the heart, it's encapsulated in the heart muscle tissue. And if the heart muscle tissue is healthy, it's not leaking out. So there would be a very low, if any, level that they can spot here under normal circumstances. They take your, they took a blood test for you and analyze this right now. They would find out there would be virtually zero value from your heart, from the isozyme of your heart. And then you have the LDH activities from, again, a heart attack. Why this changes, why these two are different, I honestly don't know. It's one of the things that you're going to find out, it'd be interesting to find out. I'm not sure why there's a change in that difference. Why they don't rise in parallel if the heart cells, muscle cells are being destroyed at the same time. So that's an interesting question that I'm sure you're going to find out eventually. Now, you can see here that B and M, let's see. What's happening here is there's a variety of isozymes. CK2 is a peculiar isozyme of creatine kinase. It has two different subunits. It's got a B subunit and an M subunit. The B and the M are different isozymes, or different proportions of isozymes from different locations. And so when we look at that, we can tell, based on the B, the relative proportion of the different subunits, we can tell what tissue that came from. That's how, in this case, CK2 is identified. The subunits proportion is different for different tissues, and therefore, based on the type of subunit that's involved, either a B subunit or M subunit, you can tell what tissue it came from. All right, but nevertheless, isozymes, enzymes that catalyze the same reaction, and so this gives you a quick idea that actually biochemistry does have some actual real purpose in existing. All right, well, oh no, another one of these. Is this kind of like death by, by a thousand cuts? Yes. Yep, it's death by a thousand cuts. I agree completely, and I'm so sorry, and I can't help it, all right? We're going to continue doing it this way. We're nearly done with the metabolism quizzes. They'll be done in the nick of time. I think we'll be done by the end of October, aren't we? I think we only have one or two left. And these become relatively straightforward and simple, actually. And then we'll get into the metabolism, and you'll see what it all's for. Glossary quiz and summary quiz, we'll see the list of that. Today is Tuesday. Typically, that's what? 3 days from today? So it's today, to Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I think you're pretty much loaded up for this week, don't you think?
Yeah.
I don't think so. No, I think. Anyway, try to have, I hope, salvage some sort of class evaluation out of this. So, we got your evaluations back from 412, 421. You're fired. Okay. Try that again. Anyway. Okay, so let's just, the nearest thing is going to be then Tuesday, is that right, next week? Yeah, let's just make it for Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. Yeah, there's a reading guide, right? Yeah, yeah. Now remember, all you need with that reading guide, just get it done and turn it into me. I'll take a look at it, make sure you accomplished it. Those reading guides, the content of the reading guide is going to be on a test, okay? Now, not the reading of the book, not the chapters, just whatever's on that reading guide. Okay, because we're just not going to get to it. Can you tell? We're not going to get to it by the end of the final. The rate we're going. Okay. There's just a lot going on, ladies and gentlemen, a tremendous amount. Like I said, you're going to be pining for the flesh pots of Andrews when you get to graduate school. All right. Ding, 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 ding. Okay, are we all ready to go, shall we? On chapter 12. Everybody got it? All right. Excellent. You guys are doing fine work. And we will eventually... No, okay, kinetics inhibition. Thought for the Day by E.M. Gray. E.M. Gray. This has actually inspired me more than many other quotes, but the successful person has the habit of doing the things failures don't like to do. They don't like to do them either, necessarily, but their disliking is subordinated to the what? Strength of their purpose. Now, there are very few among us who have such facility of mind that everything is apparently effortless. There are very few, very, very few. And many of the successful people you note around you subordinate their disliking to the strength of their purpose. And that is the key for success. What's your purpose in this life? What's your purpose in this class? To prepare yourself to be a competitive for graduate school or other types of school. That is a noble and worthwhile purpose. And you don't like doing this stuff. Honestly, in some ways, I don't like assigning it either. I wish I could simply lecture and you read and that would be it. But accountability is crucial in our environment today. And all these quizzes are actually helping many, understand this at a deeper level than they would voluntarily. So, I apologize, but only a little. So, write this down, staple it to your forehead. If you feel yourself wanting to do something childish, stop and think about your future. That's what today is all about. All right, so we're going to look at enzyme kinetics, ladies and gentlemen. Enzyme kinetics. We're going to initially take a look at some non-enzyme simple kinetics, and then enzyme kinetics, Michaelis-Menten equation, simplifying assumptions, the KM, the K-cat, the Arrhenius equation, realistic enzyme mechanisms, and graphical analysis of enzyme kinetic data. I think I might have skipped the Arrhenius equation. I don't know. I don't remember exactly. Realistic enzyme mechanisms, which is kind of a fun thing. Okay, we study kinetics to discover binding affinities. If you take a drug, I can absolutely guarantee you some biochemist somewhere has looked at the target enzyme and found out how tightly that drug attaches to it. Maximum catalytic rates, that's very important. You want more or less of that enzyme. How does it fit in the overall pathway? Catalytic mechanism, again, another powerful means for understanding what's happening at the molecular level to allow you to get an idea of what's happening in a disease state and the role of the enzyme in the overall pathway. Clinical analysis, we just went through a very quick clinical review of a very simple idea about heart attacks and how they can be measured using enzyme values. And so, clinical significance. You know, is this enzyme, you know, you've got a child that's not developing properly, and they discover there's an enzyme that's got a genetic error in it. And while it's active to some degree, which is why your child is alive, it's not what it needs to be. How can we then adjust that enzyme? How can we alter the child's environment, food, and other things to allow it to prosper? All right, so we'll take a look initially at this. Now, if you'll notice, ladies and gentlemen, what I handed you does have some blanks. And these blanks include some of the reaction equations. Now, I did not highlight them, which is my error. So it's going to be a little complicated until I'll be highlighting them next before Wednesday. But at any rate, so let's take a look at some simple reactions. You got A going to P in a single step, what it looks like a single step. Reactant A moving to product P. Well, as it turns out, of course, when you look at that kind of very simple change, you can find that there's often intermediates in between it, called 1, 2, intermediate 1, intermediate 2. And you can use kinetics to find out what kind of intermediates there are in that particular reaction. It does have some influence on the enzyme mechanisms, enzyme kinetics, how the mathematical models we use to model enzyme behavior. Then we have an idea called reaction order. What that means, and you're familiar with this, at constant temperature, the rate of an elementary reaction is proportional to the frequency with which the reacting molecules come together. Now, you're familiar with this. Let's see if I can find a piece of chalk here. For example, if you've got a rate constant, rate equation, for example. Let's take a look at one type of rate equation. We got rate is equal to K times A. Right? This reaction is first order with respect to A. And the reason that is because what is the exponent understood to be there at that A? 1. I've got to try to make it a very light circle. Let me put a triangle right there and say what number is supposed to be there. Well, it's understood a 1 is there. So this is first order with respect to A. And since this is the only only reactant, this is also first order with respect, first order overall. Now then, you can have another type that deals with this. R is equal to K. You can have A, B, in which there are two reactants colliding. And this, of course, would be first order with respect to A, colon, and also B, because the exponents here are assumed to be 1 and 1. So this is first order with respect to A, first order with respect to B, and then you'd also have what's known as second order overall. Second order overall. In other words, you sum the exponents. In a very, very rare equation, very, very rare reaction, you'd have rate is equal to K, A, perhaps B squared. You might see something like that, in which it's first order with respect to, and with respect to B, it's second order, but overall it's what? Third order. Now, the interesting thing there is the word molecularity. Molecularity. What that means here is that in order for this reaction to occur, only one reactant has to be transformed. You look here with this, A and B have to collide together. So that molecularity here is 2. It's similar to the order. With this, this says essentially that 1A and 2Bs must collide simultaneously in order to have the reaction occur. So the molecularity for this particular one is third order, as well as being third order overall. So the order is sort of saying how many things have to collide or be transformed simultaneously in order to make the reaction rate occur. Yes? Second order overall. It's a sum of the exponents. Yep. So when we look at a first order reaction, we see here that the velocity. Now, enzyme rate many times is given the term velocity. Velocity. You see it V. You also see something known as V0, which means velocity at time zero, at no time. V0. And you can look at the velocity of a first-order reaction either as, what's the dP/dt stand for? What is that? Macroscopically, it's what? The change of P over change in time. The instantaneous would be, you know, the dp over dt, the instantaneous change over an instantaneous time or microscopic time. You can also see the velocity, that's the positive production of the product, or you can see here it is the negative loss of change of A. Right? And so you end up with that KD. That KD. Of course, the dA dt would be a negative term, and so by putting a minus sign in front of it, that changes it to a positive. So in other words, the velocity would be given as a positive value, some rate constant times A. Second order, of course, is 2A to giving P, or A plus B yielding P, the product. Again, here you can have the velocity. Again, it's a change in A over time, but in this case, the rate constant reflects the molecularity, or the order of the reaction, in which the K is A squared. You can also see here where you could look at the velocity of the reaction, either loss of A, loss of B, or the K is, again, A times B. The rate is A times B. So we're just beginning to get a foundation, just a recall of general chemistry and kinetics, how that works. How that works as a mathematical modeling of what's happening in a non-catalyzed situation. Now, you can integrate these equations above, and you can get a variety of things. If you integrate dA dt, you get dt ln A is equal to minus K dt. You integrate that reaction, and you end up with this this reaction over here. Ln A is equal to ln A 0 minus KT. KT. You can rearrange that and solve for A, raise everything to a logarithm of E, raise everything to the E, and you get A is equal to A0 e to the minus KT. Now, so this is a first-order reaction, a first-order reaction. Ln of A is equal to ln A0 minus KT. And do you notice anything unique about that reaction? It actually, that equation is what type of equation? It's actually linear, if you would look at it. It's linear, in which you could say y, I'm going to write it here, y is equal to b minus mx. Or you could then write it so that ln of A equals ln, equals k minus kt plus ln A0. And so that would be the y equals mx plus b. So by looking at that, you suddenly discover, since, you know what, of course, y equals mx plus, this y equals mx plus b, of course, is the equation for a what? Straight line, and that's exactly what happened. Okay, well, I did this late in it. The reaction over an elementary reaction corresponds to the molecularity of the reaction, which is the number of molecules that must simultaneously collide to generate a product. You can fill that in right now. Okay. Now, don't panic. Are we going to do integral calculus in this class? Probably not. Can't tell you how many years it's been since I've had calculus. So, here you can see there I've repeated the reaction. I've repeated it. And there is the, I've again shown you with the linear equation. This is what it looks like. This is what it looks like. You've got the ln is the intercept. Your ln of A is the vertical axis, or dependent, and the time is the independent axis. The slope is minus k, slope. So you can find the slope of a reaction using that phrase. And it's linear over time, which is handy dandy. So for a first order reaction, plotting ln versus time gives a linear negative sloping line. Now, interestingly enough, a linear reaction like this, a first-order reaction, can give us something that gives us the half-life. This is especially true of radioactive transitions, and radioactive decay is especially dependent on something known as a half-life. So you can rearrange these equations, and you can see here that the half-life of any particular first order reaction is equal to the 0.693 divided by K with that rate constant. And so you use this a lot for radioactivity. Now, what they don't mention is what I have here in this box. They don't mention this in the text. This has to do with calculation of radioactive decay. Where the mass final is equal to the mass initial of the radioactivity divided by 2 to the nth. Where the n in that case is the number of half-lives. The number of half-lives does not have to be an integer. It does not have to be an integer. So, n is number of half-lives. If a half-life is 3 days, then over 15 days, the number of half-lives is what? 5. This makes sense. But you could do it straightforwardly in a different manner. Let's do a quick equation for that. Let's say you were given 100 milligrams of X, which is radioactive, has a half-life of 3.2 hours. Okay, milligrams, 3.2 hours. The question is, how do you like that hum? How much remains at the end of 24 hours? Okay. So following this equation, we have mass of the radioactive material final is equal to mass initial all over 2 to the n. And we calculate n very simply. We take the 24 hours total divided by the 3.2 hours per half-life per n. And we then get... could someone divide that? Anybody have a calculator handy? I would, but I'd have to turn off the audio. 24 divided by 3.2. 3.2. And someone shouts out for me, 7.5 N, or 7.5 half-lives. So we then do this. We have mass final is equal to 100 milligrams all over 2 to the 7.5. Now, 2 to the 7.5, that's a tough one. You have to use a calculator. Let's see here. What's that going to be? What is it going to be? Oh, the entire answer is... We have 100 here, milligrams, and the half number of half-lives is... I mean, the 181. And so this is... Minus final is, would you say, point something? 0.552 milligrams. So that's how you use the half-life equation to do this. In other words, that's how you can determine the amount of radioactive material left after a certain number of half-lives. Very important. So half-life, again, the time required for half the original material to be lost. Half-life. All right, well, that's the kind of the inorganic ideas that you have to deal with. So we talked initially about a very simple first-order rate reaction. We did through some very simple calculus. This follows along exactly in your text. This is nothing beyond it. Read the text. You'll find it helpful. But that's about all we're going to do with non-enzymatically catalyzed reaction kinetics. We're now going to go on to enzymatically catalyzed enzyme kinetics. All right. So, in the early 1920s, a lot of work was done on enzyme kinetics, trying to figure out exactly what's going on with an enzyme. They didn't even know that... Well, they knew they were made out of protein, but beyond that, they had no idea what these things were. So they began to create a model. They again the model was listed right here, and we'll see the historical precedent for that. But it really became evident after looking at reaction after reaction of this particular style, in which early on, when there's with low substrate concentrations, the rate was almost right in here. This is almost linear, almost first order. As they doubled the concentration of the substrate, the rate doubled. But as they began to increase the substrate concentration, it began to reach an asymptote. So that in this region right in here, this was first order, where this region down in here, as the increased concentration substrate became so large, it became zeroth order. Zeroth order. So it's zeroth order right here, first order right here. And the question is, how can we model something? What's going on at the molecular level that you'd end up having first order with relatively low concentrations of substrate, but zeroth order with much larger? And that was a question they had to answer, and they answered it with this particular model that you've seen before. We will talk with you again on Wednesday. Are we having class on Thursday?
No.
I don't know what the schedule says. What? Is it blank? All right. You sure you don't want a class on Thursday? Okay. All right. We'll see you then Wednesday. Have a great bat time. See you back here at